Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. You gotta turn that microphone down, just wrong way, turn it down a little bit. And today is the 11th of February. Let's take a look at the schedule. All right, welcome everybody to class. I'm glad you're still coming to class because guess what's happening next time? You have an exam. All right, and that is 1 week from today, and it's a week from today because Monday is a holiday. Campus is going to be closed. All the buildings are going to be closed. So even though we have some display cabinets up on the third floor, which you can look at anytime all the specimens are in there, anytime the building is open and they're labeled with numbers, and then you can like take a mock practicum and check your answers that you have with the answer key, which is pasted in that glass cabinet someplace. All right, but that won't be open on Monday because the whole building is going to be closed. Library is going to be closed. Everything's closed on Monday. So we do have that test on the 18th. It's chapters 1 through 6, except chapter 3. All right, and then the week after that, we have the practicums. So the Wednesday labs will have a review session that day as well as the exam. Okay, so we're going to finish up integument, get into skeletal system today, and that's the last material, of course, for the last test. So let's see if we can find our information that we want to look at. So does anybody have, as I'm mousing around, does anybody have any questions over what we've covered so far? Pretty good. Okay, integument. We only have to talk a little bit about skin color, so I'm not sure that... Oh, we got to talk about nails, too. All right, so I do need to get open to... okay. Lecture notes back. Okay, so let's look at this slide just for a little bit. Because also you should know something about glands. All right, so let's see if I can get this out of the way. We have some glands. We have sebaceous glands and sweat glands. What's not on this list over here, or maybe it is down over here. Oh, okay. It does have a couple different kinds of glands. Fantastic. Merocrine and eccrine glands are exactly the same thing. Same name. And I see them on this particular picture. Right, it's a bunch of coiled tubes right here. And this kind of eccrine gland secretes water and salty solution onto the surface of the skin. And when that water evaporates, that takes heat away from the body to cool the body down when it is overheating. The second kind of gland that we see on this illustration is a sebaceous gland. And I see one here, and I see one here. So just by looking at these two cases, you can say that it is always associated with what? A sebaceous gland is always associated with... Oh, yeah, thank you. I'll dim the lights. A sebaceous gland is always associated with a? Yeah, with a hair follicle. Okay. Always with a hair follicle. The kind of gland that we don't see right here is an apocrine gland. It is included on the model that we have in the lab. It is, what, maybe 3, 4, 5 times the size of the diameter of an eccrine, and that's called an apocrine gland. And apocrine glands you don't have all over your body, you just have them in the axillary and inguinal region. And it doesn't secrete water and salt, it secretes an organic solution, which is not odoriferous by itself, but since bacteria can use that as an energy source, then the bacteria sometimes can produce a bit of an odor. All right, so those are sweat glands and sebaceous glands we talked about. That these sebaceous glands secretes like a oily kind of solution that lubricates the skin, and if it's oily, then it helps protect from dehydration, and also it helps lubricate the hair as it's growing out of the hair follicle. Okay, nails. I do want to mention something about nails, because not always obvious. So let's look at a nail. Okay. Here's a nail. And so the nail grows out, okay, from this epinicium, and it is, these are skin cells. But you know the nail is harder, right? And so what's the chemical in skin that gives skin its hardness, its durability? Yeah, it's keratin. So these skin cells are keratinocytes. They just have more keratin in them, so they're harder, right? And they grow in plates, and since they're harder, they don't form like a really nice flat squamous epithelium here, but it grows out from this area. So here is the free edge of the nail, and then here is the body of the nail, and underneath this cuticle is going to be the area from which the nail grows. There is called the nail root. That's not where it grows from. It grows from the matrix. So let's look at a cross-section across a fingernail. So here's that free edge. Here's the body. Here's the cuticle. Then here's that proximal nail fold, right, that's attached to the cuticle. And then underneath the skin, we have the root of the nail, right? But that's not where it's growing from. It's growing from the nail matrix. Do y'all see that? Where does a nail grow from? Nail matrix, right? And that matrix is, of course, different than the matrix that you would see in a connective tissue, right? Because sometimes we use the same term for different things, like nucleus, for instance. It could be a nucleus of an atom, nucleus of a cell, and even some other things that we're going to talk about. All right, so nail root, nail matrix, different functions. Okay, we talked about pretty much all of these functions. Aging of skin. The lanula. Okay, so the nail root, okay, and the matrix, you see we have these folds of epidermis, and really close to them we have a lot of blood vessels. Okay, and so right in this region, right, I don't see any epidermis on top of the nail like I do at the nail root and nail matrix. Right, and so this region right here just is not as dark, doesn't have as much blood supply as these other places of the nail. And when you look down through the nail, right, you see this white area, and that's called the lanula of the nail, just because it's just an area underneath the nail that is not very, very vascular. So it doesn't look quite so pink. Right, it's going to look more white. This is an exam figure. This is the exam figure right here. And we can even see the bone in your finger. And what do we call bones in your fingers? We're going to talk about this real soon. It's on the slide. The bone in your fingers, better way of saying this, the bones in your digits are called phalanges. Okay? So phalanges make up a digit, and your digits are your fingers and your toes. That can be a little bit confusing sometimes. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about aging. Oh, no, I talked about that already. And what do I want to talk about? Skin color? Okay, glands, muscles. Accessory skin structures like nails, muscles, the erector pili muscle. I mentioned that it's attached to a hair follicle. And all of the sensory apparatus, like a Pacinian corpuscle, those are accessory structures, right? As well as hair, right? So hair is just a thread-like structure. Let me see if I can pull one up over here. Hair follicle. Okay, so here we have an illustration of a hair follicle. And here we have something that almost looks like a dermal papillae. And this is where blood vessels do come up into this area right here, and it nourishes all these cells. So this layer here would be analogous to the stratum basale in skin. So this is the living area of a hair follicle, and it's growing. So what kind of process is happening if it is growing? Yeah, mitosis. So this is where mitosis is taking place, right? And then that pushes cells up toward the surface of the skin, and instead of forming flat plates like they do in a nail, these cells form more like a columnar structure. So you see a column here and a column here and a column there. So here are a bunch of squamous cells that are just kind of like forming a ring around this hair follicle as it grows. So this is what we call the bulb of a hair follicle. Then below the surface of the skin, we have the root. And then above the surface of the skin, which we can't quite see, is the shaft of a hair follicle. All right, so think of bulb, root, and shaft are the three pieces of a hair follicle. And of course, there's always going to be a sebaceous gland associated with it, and there's always going to be an arrector pili muscle associated with it. And I think I mentioned that that is smooth muscle. You can't control when it contracts. But for instance, when you're cold or certain emotional kind of stimuli, it does contract, controlled by the autonomic nervous system, and it pulls this hair follicle, okay, kind of straightens it up. It pulls the bulb and the root toward it, right, so the hair shaft sticks straight up, and it tries to pull it out of the skin, so it forms a little bit of a pimple right here, otherwise known as a goose bump or a goose pimple. I don't know what the nice anatomical term for that is. All right, so that's... okay, that's a hair. We could look at hair if you want. In lab, we can get out a microscope and take a look at it if you want. And you'll be able to see these columns. They will kind of look like plates if we look at on the side of a hair follicle. All right, also in a hair follicle, all right, there will be melanocytes in this region right here, which do what for hair? It gives it color, right? And so there's a whole range of color, and I think we're going to talk about that as well. I also mentioned that since this is epidermis that goes, here is a layer of epidermis that goes way down deep into the dermis, right, goes way down deep over here, that acts as a reservoir of epidermal cells. In case the epidermis is damaged, these cells can help regenerate skin in these other areas on either side of the hair follicle. All right, so hair color is a function of the amount and the color of melanin. And if somebody has red hair, those melanocytes are incorporating a little bit of an iron ion into the color of the keratinocytes. And if somebody doesn't have melanocytes, then this hair is going to look perfectly white. And that's a congenital condition. I don't even want to call it an abnormality, but it's not absolutely normal. And what do we call that condition when somebody doesn't have any functioning melanocytes? That's albinism, right? And so this hair is going to look perfectly white because there's absolutely no melanin in these keratinocytes at all, one way or the other. All right, so that is hair, muscle. And we're going to finish up with skin color. I think we got through all this. Didn't we get through all this? Okay, for some reason I thought I had to go back and talk about skin color. All right, so what color is jaundice? Yellow. What color is cyanosis?
Blue.
Okay, what color is albinism? Yeah, white, absolutely white. And normal skin will have a little bit of a reddish hue to it, right, because of blood that is going through the dermis. Right, and even a birthmark is due to just a localized increase in vascularity in some region of the skin. And I guess what I should have been thinking about is what? Aging of the skin. And so when you think about aging of the skin, like in many places of the body, what you should always be thinking about is blood supply. All right, so if a tissue has blood supply, then it's easy to regenerate, it's easy to grow. Like bones are highly vascular, so it's easy for bones to grow after they're fractured because there's a lot of blood supply. So same thing for the skin, right? As we age, skin becomes thinner and more transparent. There is less collagen in the dermis, so that means that our skin as we get older is more easily damaged, and it repairs very slowly as we get older, right? So why does it repair itself more slowly as we get older? It's kind of on this slide right here. And that's because the blood vessels start, it doesn't have the same perfusion. It doesn't get the same amount of blood as when we're younger. Right? And so the fibroblasts can't make as much collagen, right? And fibroblasts make another protein, and those are the elastic fibers. And so our skin loses elasticity as we grow older as well as a result of decreased blood flow to the skin. So a lot of people are very interested in maintaining their skin as young as possible, right, by putting on all kinds of topical kind of solutions and lotions which might contain keratin, which might contain collagen, right? So these are just topical applications on top of the epidermis. But if somebody wants to maintain really young skin, what do they have to do? Yeah, protect themselves from the sun, because the sun helps destroy those blood vessels. So if somebody wants young skin, the treatment would be to maintain blood vessels in the skin. And nobody really knows how to do that just yet. Right, so there really, I don't think there's really a good therapy for maintaining skin. But of course, keeping it hydrated, lubricated with some kind of lipids, that certainly helps. And of course, stay out of the sun. As you age, the activity of sweat glands and sebaceous glands decrease. And so if a sweat gland, like an eccrine sweat gland, doesn't function quite as well as when in a younger person, what does the older person have to be concerned with? What's the function of an eccrine sweat gland? Eccrine, that's the small one, not the big apocrine, but the small one. It secretes a water and salty solution to cool a person down. So as we get older, we have a harder time maintaining proper body temperature. So it's easier to overheat as we get older. But there's also another population that has poor temperature regulation. So if there's a heat wave, sometimes you hear on the news, stay inside, right? Especially if what? If you're an elderly person, because they have trouble losing heat in their body, but also, what, infants for sure, okay? They have trouble with regulating temperature. A couple years ago, in France, there was a heat wave in the middle of summer. And I don't know if anybody is familiar with Europe, but in the summertime, what happens to everybody? They just don't go to work. They're on vacation almost all summer long, right? And it gets pretty warm, so everybody goes down to the Mediterranean, and whoever can't travel, like grandma and grandpa, they stay at home and kind of take care of the house while everybody's down on the beaches having fun. And one year, it got super hot, and everybody was down at the Mediterranean, and who was left at home without air conditioning was grandma and grandpa. And there were like tens of thousands of elderly people dying in southern Europe, France, Portugal, okay, Italy, because no one was home to take care of them. That was just amazing. So elderly people have severe difficulty regulating body temperature, especially hyperthermia. So you got any grandparents at home, okay, just be cautious. Watch them if it gets really hot. Don't let them have a lot of exercise when it's really hot, because they just can't lose that body heat. Okay, gray-white hair, result of decreased melanocyte function in the hair follicle. All right, so that's what happens with skin. So again, it's really just a result of decreased blood supply to the skin causes all of these effects, like loss of elasticity, loss of strength. If it is damaged, it just takes much longer to heal as a result of that. And since the function of eccrine sweat glands is reduced, then they're really sensitive to hyperthermia. All right, so that's it for skin. Any questions on skin? Yeah.
In terms of hair?
Yeah.
When we get a random white hair,
yeah,
does that relate to melanocyte aging process?
You know, I'm not so sure it's related to the aging process. There are melanocytes in certain areas, like in that hair follicle, that just aren't producing melanin, and then that hair is going to just have that white appearance. I'm not sure stress has any effect on it. I certainly have heard that before. Let's see. That raises that. I remember an interesting question. So as we get older, what happens to our hair color? Yeah, it turns white, right? Your melanocytes lose activity. And as we get older, does our skin turn white? Okay, that's strange. That struck me as being really strange. Right, even people from Africa, African Americans, their hair turns white, but what about their skin? Never turns white. So how would you explain that? And that is because as we age, the blood vessels, right, in this hair papillae are much more sensitive to degradation than the blood vessels in the dermal papillae, right? So our skin has enough blood supply to keep those melanocytes producing melanin in skin, but not so much in this hair follicle, right? So always think of blood supply. There's a couple other abnormalities, abnormal conditions where you have white spaces on your skin. And one kind of thing comes to mind is vitiligo. And vitiligo is just a regional area where melanocytes are not producing melanin, so it's going to be a very bright white spot. And I had a nephew that had vitiligo, and it was on his forehead. Okay. And he had to be really careful because every time he went outside, right, that area, even though he's from the South Pacific mostly, his skin was pretty dark, could go out without getting sunburned. But what about that white spot right there? Would burn very easily, right? So even though maybe the rest of his body was protected pretty much from sunlight, that white spot wasn't, so he'd always have to wear hair over that sunspot, I mean that white spot, or a cap or something to protect that area. Okay, so that kind of underscores the beauty of those melanocytes. Yeah?
Alopecia,
you know, it's not coming back to me. I think at one time I knew something about alopecia, but I forgot everything about it. Maybe after class, I'll take a look and refresh my memory with that. Yeah, but that's a... Somebody with vitiligo, it might relate to alopecia. The reason why somebody with vitiligo has that white spot right there is because we think that white blood cells, which are responsible for immune response, for protecting your body from foreign microorganisms, that in that one area of the body, the person's immune system recognizes those melanocytes as being a foreign cell to that person's body. So the person's immune system attacks the melanocytes in that area and they die and it results in that white blotch. Right, so that's what we call an autoimmune disease. And we're going to look at autoimmune diseases in other parts of the body, like brain, for instance. Autoimmune disease. Arthritis. Rheumatoid arthritis is also considered an autoimmune disease, where a person's own immune system attacks cartilage in their body. So that might have something to do with alopecia, but I gotta remember what it is. Okay? Yeah. All right, so those are good questions. All right, let's go on to the next chapter. Next chapter, right, is bone, introduction to bone. So that is chapter 6. Nice. Let me get a word slide for you. Maybe I'll put this over here for now. I'll get rid of the syllabus. Let's look at this slide. All right, so what do we have right here on that slide as I go find our text file? What do we have there? What do we have right there? Yeah, we have the skeleton, okay, and we have cartilage. And so what we have here is the skeletal system, right? It's an organ system. And I do see the skeleton. And nice. So let's look at the composition of the skeletal system. So for sure it's bones and it's cartilage. How many different kinds of cartilage are you aware of? There are three. The softest kind is hyaline cartilage, right? And it's signified by this little blue color. Hyaline cartilage is used at the ends of bones where there's joints, so sometimes that's called articular cartilage, and hyaline cartilage is the same. And what can you tell me about the fibers in the matrix of hyaline cartilage? There aren't any to see, right? So it's a very light kind of cartilage, but it's not very strong. All right, the next kind, for instance, like we see, right, with this color right here, where should I look to find cartilage with this color? You see it, you see that color right in here? I'm glad. I didn't want to say because I don't see it. But it is the ear, right? It's elastic cartilage. Elastic fibers can bend, they can stretch. As long as they're not overbent or overstretched, they go back to their original location. So, and also, right, fibrocartilage, like for instance in the menisci of knees, the pubic symphysis, that's the toughest kind of cartilage there is because it has a lot of collagen fibers. All right, cartilage is really good because it's light compared to bones. So it takes less energy to move that part of our body around compared to if it was a bone. Right? Plus, it's a little bit spongy, so it can absorb some shock and some trauma. And it, like bone, it can take a certain kind of shape. It can produce a structure in the body, for instance, like an ear, right, or a nose, but it's not heavy like bone is. So what do we have for the skeletal system? We got bones, we got cartilage, and something that's not shown on the slide, and that is ligaments. Ligaments is dense, regular connective tissue, so it's a very strong kind of connective tissue, and it joins bones together, so it's a bone-to-bone connection. It's very similar to a tendon, but a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. Ligament is bone-to-bone, and I don't see any ligaments on this particular slide. Okay, so that is the skeleton. What are some of these functions? Well, bone is very rigid, and it's very strong, and so we can say that it helps support your body, right? So when you stand up, all of your muscles, right, that are attached to the skeleton, they move with you, right? And the skeleton can just support where those muscles are. And what else? Internal organs are in a particular location in your body, and they're surrounded by bones, and so these bones form cavities, and those organs then just travel around with you inside those body cavities. That's a kind of a support that you should think of. The other thing, okay, so here is a bone way down here. What part of the body is this between your knee and your ankle? Knee and ankle is your, indeed, that is your leg, right? What's between your knee and your hip? That's your thigh, okay? So I want to talk about this bone here in your leg. It's a big, strong bone. And another feature of bone is that it doesn't compress, right? So it bears a lot of weight without shrinking down. So that's another important thing with bone. So it's good for support, but it can carry a lot of weight without compressing and without fracturing if it's a nice, healthy bone. All right, so what did I say about cartilage? Flexible but lightweight. All right, here's where you find some. And during development, there are certain bones in our body that are made from cartilage first. Right, the shape of that bone is made from cartilage. For instance, like this bone right here in the forearm, like the radius bone in the forearm, it's made out of cartilage first, and then that cartilage model of where the bone should be ossifies or turns into bone. That process is called ossification, and we're going to look at that a little bit later in the chapter. All right, so those are the functions of cartilage. Protection, that's an important function of the skeletal system. Like, what does the cranium, bones of the cranium, what does it protect? That brain. Yeah, so the cranium is armor plating to protect the brain that's deep inside that cavity. The vertebral column, all these vertebrae right here, even though it's not nice and continuous like cranial bones, again, that is armor plating that protects the spinal cord. Okay, we got the sternum and ribs over here. Again, you should consider that armor plating that protects the heart and lungs, which are, of course, vital organs as well. All right, so bones for protection. Skeleton's important for movement because muscles attach between two different bones. And what's the function of muscle? What is it specialized to do once again? Contract, and when that muscle contracts, it moves, brings these two bones together, right? And that produces motion in the skeleton, right? So muscles contract, but it produces motion when those muscles are attached to bones. Bones are also important area for storing various kinds of chemicals. And some of these compounds are calcium ions, and also inorganic phosphate. And both calcium and phosphate are necessary to make bones, but calcium and phosphate are necessary in all the tissues of our body, all the cells need the proper levels of calcium. And as we get older, it's more and more difficult to maintain proper calcium levels in our blood as we get older. So guess where your body gets calcium? So it goes to bones as we get older to put calcium back into the blood to maintain proper blood calcium levels. Right? And that produces, unfortunately, an abnormal condition that we call osteoporosis. We're going to talk some more about that later on in the class as well. All right, it's also a storage area for fat, because deep inside these bones, this is a typical long bone, there is a big cavity. And that cavity, as we're growing, is filled with something we call red bone marrow. Red bone marrow makes red blood cells. But as we get older, that area that produces red blood cells mostly shrinks down to only the ascoxae right here, right? And some of, and maybe not even the vertebrae, but ascoxae, okay? Maybe some ribs and sternum, and that's it. So what happens then, the red bone marrow turns into yellow bone marrow, and yellow bone marrow is just fat. And so that's a storage area of energy for our body. So that area is not wasted. So that process of red bone marrow is that makes red blood cells, we call that hematopoiesis, right? Or hemopoiesis. Hemo means blood. It's a part of a red blood cell. Poiesis is making blood. Hemopoiesis is making red blood cells. And so I think maybe you could synthesize the word for making white blood cells. Could you think of what the word is that we use for making white blood cells? You know what? Oh, tell you what. Hemopoiesis means red and white blood cells. And if you're thinking about just red blood cells, guess what we have to do to hemo? Erythropoiesis. Yeah, erythropoiesis is for making red blood cells. So the process for making white blood cells is called leukopoiesis. Yeah, modify your notes a little bit. All right, so what is a hemopoietic tissue? It's some kind of tissue that can make blood cells. Okay, for instance, like red bone marrow. All right, the types of cartilage. Well, we talked about these pretty much already. What is a cell inside cartilage called? Chondrocyte, because chondro means cartilage. Right, the types, you know, are hyaline, or another name for that is articular cartilage. And in all of these different cartilages, these chondrocytes exist in a lacunae. And a lacuna is like a little bubble or a pit within the matrix of that particular connective tissue. And hyaline cartilage doesn't have any fibers. It just has the soluble collagen within the matrix, so you don't see those fibers. Where we have that, nose, articulation, around the ribs, larynx, right? That's your Adam's apple is hyaline cartilage, all right? And even the rings around trachea are made out of hyaline cartilage, right? Elastic, I think we talked about already. So it's a kind of cartilage that is used where some area in your body is bending, changing shape all the time. And we don't really change our shape of our nose, but it has, our ear. We don't wiggle our ears around, but nonetheless it has elastic cartilage. But there is a part of our system that we use to swallow food that moves around every time that we swallow and breathe, and it's called the epiglottis. All right, so that thing is moving all the time. When we get into the respiratory system, we'll pay particular attention to this epiglottis, because when it doesn't function properly, then we can choke, because it protects the airway. It moves into a certain position to close off the airway, so when we swallow something, it goes into our stomach instead of our lungs. And if it doesn't work, then that fluid and food that we're eating ends up in our lungs, and it could occlude or block an airway. So that's an important thing. Fibrocartilage resists compression. Fibrocartilage is the closest kind of cartilage to bone, right? Because it has all of those collagen fibers, and it's the strongest kind. All right, so let's look at some bones, bone tissue, moving away from cartilage. We have some different types of bones by their shape. All right, so here's a bone by their shape. And if we have a bone in one dimension that is very large, and in the two other dimensions it's relatively short, we call that a long bone. Okay, and a long bone does not have to be big. A long bone can be really tiny. It can be short. All right, but if it's still a long distance, a big distance in one dimension and short in the other two, we call that a long bone. Here's the humerus in our arm. We've got radius and ulna in our forearm. Those are easy to tell. They're long bones. But we also have long bones in our digits. And remember what those were called? Ones in our digits? Those were phalanges, right? So the phalanges that make up your digits are long bones. I mean, they're tiny, so they're short, but they're still relatively long in one dimension compared to the other two, so they're still considered long bones. A good example of a short bone would be some bones of the wrist and ankle. So here's a bone in the ankle. This is just called a short bone because all the dimensions, no matter how you look at it, it looks like it's the same length. All right, so we just call that a short bone. Even though these phalanges, some of these phalanges are shorter than this one, right? The phalanges are still long in one dimension. We have flat bones. Here is the sternum. All of this is the sternum. It's got these three different pieces. This is the body. Here's the manubrium. Here's a xiphoid process, right? That helps make up the thoracic cavity. It's a flat bone. So when we look at it, of course, it's going to be really flat, even though it has a big distance, a long distance in one axis and short in the other two. We still call it a flat bone because it's really thin. Some bones have a very weird shape to them. They have a bunch of processes sticking out in all kinds of directions. And there's big, heavy, strong parts and then weak parts to this bone. This is called a vertebrae. It helps make the vertebral column that protects the spinal cord. And so we call that an irregular bone. And one thing that's not shown very well on this slide, there are some bones that are completely surrounded by a tendon, right? And that's a little bit different because usually bones exist on either side of a tendon, but not right smack in the middle of a tendon. And here is a bone that's located right smack in the middle of a tendon, and it's called the patella. And the patella is just another name for kneecap. So there is a big tendon that comes down from muscles that are in your anterior thigh and then attaches to this big strong bone in your leg. We call that the tibia. So there is that dense regular connective tissue going from that muscle to the tibia. But before it gets there, right, it joins with the patella. And that patella is completely surrounded by that tendon that's coming from that muscle that we call the quadriceps. That's a sesamoid bone. We have a couple other sesamoid bones. We have one in our thumb. And other than that, that's pretty much the normal locations. But they can develop spontaneously in tendons that are overused, for instance. And, of course, that causes irritation and inflammation. But the patella is a normal sesamoid bone. So those are some types of bones. Parts of a long bone. So let's look at this long bone right here. We're going to use this as a model to figure out how bones are made. All right, so a bone is an organ. All right, it's an organ, it's living tissue. What kind of cells does it have? I haven't mentioned that recently. What kind of cells does bone have? Yeah, osteocytes is a bone cell. And since those bone cells are there, it needs a vascular system to stay healthy. So bones are highly vascular to support those osteocytes. So the bones that you have, I've lost this reference, but basically the bones that you've had, that you have in your body, weren't there 5 years ago. Every 5 years you rejuvenate, you rebuild that skeleton because those osteocytes and other kinds of cells are rebuilding bone all the time for you. So it's not like that cement column that we see in this building. A column is supporting the building. Bones are supporting our body, but they're really inherently different because that column is not a living tissue. But bones certainly are highly vascular. Any kind of organ will have a superficial part. What does superficial mean? On the surface, right? On the surface. We're going to call that the cortex. The cortex of any organ is going to be superficially located on that organ. So here I see cortical bone, right? Here's superficial bone. And then we have bone that is deep. And any organ that has a deep part away from the cortex, we're going to call that the medulla. So even a bone has a medulla. So here we see cortical bone on the outside, and deep inside the bone we have medullary bone. And you can tell that it has a different appearance. Medullary bone kind of looks like a sponge. Cortical bone is more solid. Right. And then also, as a bone is developing, here's that cavity that develops on the inside of a bone. And what would we want to call this cavity? Would we want to call this a cortical cavity or a medullary cavity? Medullary, because it's deep inside the bone. So that's why we call this the medullary cavity. All bones have this. Sometimes it's filled with red bone marrow, sometimes with yellow. And in this particular case, the medullary cavity is storing fat for us. Right, because I only see yellow bone marrow. And so that's the deep part, superficial part, medullary cavity. All right, let's look at the ends of a bone. So here is a tip, and we have a tip down over here. This is the one that's connected to your torso. And so it's proximal compared to this one that's farther away from your body. So this is the distal end. And the end of a bone is what we call an epiphysis. So here's the proximal epiphysis. Here is the part of this bone that attaches to your scapula. Here is the part of that bone that attaches to your elbow that's farther away. So that's the distal epiphysis. And then the part of a long bone between the epiphyses is what we call the shaft, or you could call it the diaphysis. Diaphysis and shaft are exactly the same thing. So we got the epiphyses, diaphysis. There's a membrane that completely surrounds the bone on the outside. And when we think of something surrounding something, we would like to use this term peri. Like pericardium is the membrane that surrounds the heart, right? And so the membrane that surrounds bone, I mentioned this a long time ago, is called the periosteum. How would you know that periosteum is associated with bone? Because you see osteo right in that word. Okay, so a periosteum covers every exterior surface right on the bone. So is that a cortical surface or a medullary surface? Yeah, it's cortical, right? All right, there's also a membrane that lines every cavity deep inside the bone. That's not what we call the periosteum. That's what we're going to call the endosteum. Endosteum is the membrane inside the bone. Right, it lines the medullary cavity. It lines all these spaces and spongy bone as well. So we said that bone is highly vascular. Here is a blood vessel going into bone. And so there's usually a foramen. Sometimes we can see it on the diaphysis of a long bone. And we're just going to call that a nutrient foramen. Because why? It brings nutrients into that bone. Nutrient foramen. Is it labeled on the slide? Maybe it's labeled, maybe not. All right, so if we zoom in to this area, we can see cortical bone, right? Well, first we can see the periosteum. We can see cortical bone, and we can see medullary bone, just difference in its structure, right? And then on the surface of all of that medullary bone, you have the endosteum. So that's what I see pointing right here. So cortical bone, sometimes we call it compact bone because it doesn't have all those little spaces. Sometimes medullary bone we call spongy bone. They go by the same name. And some of these even have some other names that we're going to look at in just a little bit. All right, in lab, this is the presentation of bone that I really wanted you to see, which is what, a nice transverse section across the bone. And when you have this transverse section, you see all of these tubes or circular structures, right? So that circular structure is really a tube that's going up and down the length of a bone. And just that, the shape of that tube prevents compression. That's the job of a tubular structure. So let me take this marker right here. Consider this marker a tube. And you know what? If I grab this tube pretty strongly and I start to bend it, eventually I'm going to be able to snap that tube. All right, so if we put lateral torsion or deformation on that tube, I'll be able to break it. But what happens if I start to push on this tube from end to end? Will I ever be able to break this marker? Pushing on it from end to end, there's just no way. That's the shape of a tube, right? And so bones, these long bones, are tubes next to tubes next to tubes, and there's even tubes inside of tubes. So a long bone does not compress, basically by the way it's made, but also by some chemicals that are inside bone as well. But just that tubular structure is very important. Some of the connective tissue that connects the periosteum to the bone, we call these Sharpey's fibers or perforating fibers. And you can see some holes in the center of all of these circles. We're going to call that the central canal of all of these circles. And as a matter of fact, we're going to look at analyze one of those circles a little bit more, in a little bit more detail. Okay. Here it is. So here we've cut into the bone, right, and we can see all of these, and we call them lamella. You had to know that in lab. Here's that central canal, and it has arteries, veins, and even nerves in there. And this structure is just a repeating structure over and over and over again that we see in what kind of bone? Compact bone, cortical bone. So this thing has got a name. It's called an osteon, right? Osteobone, osteon. That is the structural and functional unit of compact bone, osteon. So if you understand how one osteon is put together, you understand pretty much how that whole bone is put together. So we're interested in analyzing one osteon. Okay, so these are what we call, these are lamellae, but there's a certain name. It will come to me in just a second. What kind of lamellae? We also see some lamellae that surround all of these osteons. These are what we call circumferential lamellae because they surround the whole bone. And these that surround that central canal, oh, dang, I had it just a second ago as I was talking. These are what we call, circumferential. Okay, it's going to come back to me in just a second. Circumferential. I should have just yelled it out loud when I remembered it. Okay, so all of these things are what we call an osteon. It's got these concentric lamellae. That's what the term I was trying to think of. Concentric surround the central canal. Sometimes we call that haversian canal. Sometimes this osteon is called a haversian system of all these concentric lamellae. And do you see these little holes in bone? Those are lacunae, and inside those lacunae are cells, but we call those osteocytes, right? Osteocytes, not chondrocytes. Okay, and so here you see tubes inside tubes, and so that physical structure resists compression, which is something that bone should do. All right, so here it's just labeled lamellae, but you should actually know those to be what? Concentric lamellae. The ones that go around the whole bone are circumferential lamellae. The central canals have these blood vessels and nerves, and they're aligned along the long axis of the bone, but there's also canals between these haversian systems, right? And we're going to call these perforating canals. They contain blood vessels as well and nerves. So you can imagine when this bone is fractured, then hemorrhage is a very serious consideration. Somebody can actually bleed to death when they fracture a bone because of all of these blood vessels in there. Remember, bone is definitely a living tissue. All right, so I see compact bone. Okay, cortical bone is dense. Medullary bone. Here are some other names for medullary bone. Spongy bone. Same thing, right? Cancellous bone. So here is spongy bone, here's medullary bone. Sometimes people call that cancellous bone. All these bony plates are called trabeculae. And so some people call this trabecular bone. Right? So trabecular bone is not cortical bone, not compact bone. And all of these trabeculae in a flat bone is what we call diploid. And I have a picture of diploid someplace when I get to it. All right, so a flat bone doesn't have a medullary cavity, but it has diploid nonetheless. It has these tiny cavities within the trabeculae. All right, so I do believe this is an exam figure, right? So could you label all of these things, especially this one here that I forgot, concentric lamellae and circumferential on the outside. All right, I think we want to zoom in maybe a little bit more to see some structures. Anybody have a question? I thought I heard a question. A question? We're good so far? Okay. So we're looking at just a little piece of an osteon or haversian system. And I can see the osteocytes within these lacunae. And material can move by diffusion through a gas or a liquid very easily. Like if I opened up a perfume bottle right here, and without any kind of fan or current, that perfume would evaporate, and eventually people in the first row would smell it, then the second row, and then if we waited a couple hours or half a day, even all the way back in the back of the room, that perfume molecule will move, right, from a high concentration to low concentration. But that can only happen in a gas or a liquid. Material cannot diffuse through a solid material like this tabletop. Right? Diffusion does not happen because all those molecules are tightly held together. So this bone, in compact bone, is a solid material, and things cannot diffuse through solid bone like oxygen. Right, and nutrients, for instance, like glucose, waste products like carbon dioxide, maybe lactic acid. So how do those things exchange with the blood? Well, they move through this little crack right here. That's a normal crack. That's what we call, right, a canaliculi. And that allows for diffusion of nutrients that we need, like glucose and oxygen, waste products from these cells. Eventually they can get into a blood vessel, right, for exchange. So these canaliculi are very important. It just is a way of connecting all of these osteocytes together. And they're pretty easy to see, even underneath the microscope. We saw those canaliculi. Okay, some examples. All right, let's look at the chemical composition of bones. When we look at a bone, there are two main components of bone. There are things that we call organic components, and then there are things that we call inorganic components. Let me define what an organic component is. It's something that has a carbon atom, and it's got something else which we're not too concerned with, but maybe for this class you could think of anything that has a carbon atom as being an organic molecule. Most important biological molecules are organic. They have carbon atoms associated with them. As opposed to an inorganic chemical or compound, for us, we're going to say it doesn't have carbon. It has other things like phosphorus and calcium associated with us. All right, so those usually are not associated with any kind of special living process inside our body, but we do need these things. But those are inorganic components of bone. So something that organic components make are cells. It has a lot of carbon components, cell membrane, like proteins and lipids, nucleic acids made with carbon atoms. So let's look at some cells. You know one kind of cell. What kind of cell do you know in bone so far? An osteocyte. Yeah, so an osteocyte is a mature bone cell. It maintains that bone in a healthy manner. Right, so that is called an osteocyte. There are two other kinds of bone cells that I want you to know. There's one called an osteoclast. There's one that's called an osteoblast. And remember, I said that our bones are rebuilt every 5 years. Well, that means that your bone has to be broken down and then rebuilt again. Right? And the type of cell that breaks bone down is an osteoclast. Its job is to break bone down, but of course we still want a skeleton. We don't want it to disappear completely. And it's the job of the osteoblast to rebuild bone. And so, what can you tell me about the relationship between an osteoblast and an osteoclast? This is probably the most important, like, concept in this class. The relationship between those two cells. Okay. Yeah, do they work together or do they work against, opposite each other, against each other? Okay. One builds, one breaks down. So they work against each other, but you're right, there is an equilibrium that's established. We call that antagonism. These cells are antagonistic to each other. And so here is a really good example at the cellular level of how important antagonism is. It's just a controlled mechanism, and it's just controlling the proper size and shape of this bone to match your particular healthy lifestyle. And so antagonism is super important. And we could relate, we're going to relate this to the musculoskeletal system when we get into muscles, but we could relate this to an automobile right now. Can you think of two mechanisms that you have in your car that are antagonistic to each other, that work in opposition? And would you ever think of driving your car without those two things that work in opposition to each other? And what are those two things? The accelerator and brake pedal, right? So if you have these two things working against each other in opposition, in an antagonistic mode, you have precise control and balance over your car. Precise control and balance are the key concepts there for antagonistic systems. All right, so if you had a gas pedal and no brake, right, you could drive home tonight when you're done with work, but when you got home, what would you do? Well, you just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop. Right? So you need this antagonistic control mechanism that's very important. So here it is at the cellular level, a really good example. These cells come from a progenitor cell, right? A cell that comes before, osteoprogenitor. Sorry. I'll just get a little sip of water.
You all noticed this was a fresh bottle, right? So there's just Coke in there, nothing else.
My voice usually comes back in just a second. I don't know where it goes, but it will come back. Okay, let's try that. It's coming back. That's why I like to use a microphone. It helps my voice every once in a while. Okay, so what the heck were we talking about? Oh, this progenitor cell. Okay, that's a stem cell, and a stem cell can be a number of different kinds of cells when it develops, and it can turn into an osteoblast, which breaks down bone. Wow, it's going away again. I mean, an osteoblast is what? I misspoke. What does an osteoblast do? It builds bone up. Right. And it's the clasp that breaks bone down. Yeah. Exactly. What happens in your car if all of a sudden when you touch the brakes, it's way too sensitive compared to what you're used to, right? So you touch the brake, your car really slows down, and even if you touch the accelerator, it doesn't go. So if these systems aren't balanced, then you lose control. So we talked about a condition called osteoporosis, when we start to lose calcium and our bones get brittle. It's mostly a result of the balance between osteoblasts and osteoclasts. So the osteoblasts start to work a little bit harder than normal. The osteoclasts start to work a little bit harder than normal compared to the blast, and as a result of that, then that balance of bone is that we lose bone, right? So that, and these things are controlled by other kinds of mechanisms in our body, and people are really studying that because we don't really want to have osteoporosis. So if we can stimulate these osteoblasts in somebody that has osteoporosis, that would be a really nice way to treat that abnormal condition. Okay, where we have osteoblasts, right, the cells that build bone up are in the periosteum. Okay, so periosteum has osteoblasts. Osteoclasts you can find in the endosteum. So what does that mean if we look at this bone right here? So a bone is going to grow in diameter from the periosteum because that's the part where bone is growing from. But what do you find on the interior, the medullary part of a bone? All of these cavities, like a medullary cavity, these spaces between the trabeculae. And what kind of cell produces that medullary cavity? It's not an osteocyte because that maintains mature bone. It's not an osteoblast because that builds bone up. We're not building bone. What are we doing with bone here? We are dissolving it away. So what kind of cell is dissolving this medullary part of the bone so that you have that nice medullary cavity. Those are the, right, those are the osteoclasts. So mostly in the endosteum you find osteoclasts, and mostly in the periosteum you have osteoblasts. Okay, there is another organic compound besides cells, and that is some of the fibers that are secreted into the matrix by fibroblasts or by osteocytes and osteoblasts. And you know one to be collagen. So what do you know about collagen? It's really, really strong, right? So that adds some strength to a bone. So collagen is very important. It also gives bone a little bit of flexibility and tensile strength. Well, what does that mean? Tensile strength means that bones don't stretch as a result of that, right? Because those collagen fibers don't stretch, bones don't stretch, bones don't compress, and that's those are two different kinds of forces that bones can withstand very nicely. So bones resist stretching. We call that tension. They resist torsion or twisting, and that's because of that organic component in bone that we call collagen. All right, if you look at that concrete column over there, concrete is really good for resisting compression. It can hold the whole building up. But as soon as you take that column and start to stretch it, apply tension as opposed to compression, here's something that's really sad. That concrete column is just going to break away. It's just going to dissolve around into just little tiny particles. So concrete, good for compression, but not for tension. All right, bones, on the other hand, are good for compression as well as tension because of these different components, right? Tension due to this collagen. Let's look at some of the inorganic components. So we're not going to talk about fibers. We're not talking about collagen or cells. We're going to look at some minerals, namely calcium. So here is a calcium ion, inorganic phosphate. Looks like this. It incorporates some oxygen atoms, and then calcium is incorporated into this inorganic phosphate to produce something called calcium phosphate. Here's a chemical symbol for calcium phosphate. You don't have to remember any of these chemical symbols or how these things are put together, but I think it's a good idea that you understand that bone has more than just calcium in it. And then these things are put together to make a compound that we call hydroxyapatite. And hydroxyapatite really is the chemical compound, right, that we have in bones that give bones its strength. All right, so collagen resists stretching and twisting. That hydroxyapatite resists compression. All right, so if we put those organic and inorganic components together, then we get a bone that doesn't stretch, doesn't twist, and doesn't compress. And so that's really handy. Okay, I got to go forward on the slide a little bit, like right here. All right, so here I see different lamellae, different concentric lamellae that make up an osteon. And in between the lamellae, I see these collagen fibers. And from one lamellae to the next deeper one, what can you tell me about the orientation of these collagen fibers? They're opposite each other, right? And so, again, that opposition in the way that these fibers travel gives these different layers a lot of strength. If they were all lined up together, they wouldn't be nearly as strong, right? Maybe you've looked at plywood at some point in time. Plywood has a number of different layers. Wood has grain to it. And in plywood, the grains are all oriented from one layer to the next perpendicular to each other. And so plywood is really strong as a result of that. So these collagen fibers help resist tension and twisting. And the hydroxyapatite, right, resists compression. So bone is really nice. It's really good. So make sure you know what components of bone resist torsion, which is twisting, compression, right, that's easy, and tension is what, pulling from end to end, those organic compounds. All right, the microscopic structure of bones, we talked about that already. Did I miss any of this? No, I didn't. What is the structural and functional unit of compact bone called? Yeah, that osteon, you know all those pieces of an osteon. You know how compact bone everywhere in your body is put together. Okay, there is one thing about a long bone that I did not talk about, so I want to go back. Let's go back to this long bone. All right, so superficially, I can see some compact bone. But look at this epiphysis up over here and the union with the diaphysis. So here is a little area right here. And what does that bone look like? Does it look like spongy bone or compact bone? It's compact bone. I wouldn't want to call it cortical bone because it's not in the cortical surface, but nonetheless, it is compact bone. And that line is there because of the way this bone developed. It used to grow before puberty at this surface between the epiphysis and diaphysis, so sometimes we call this the growth plate, this epiphyseal line. And as we're growing, it is not solid bone, but it is cartilage. And that's what we would call the epiphyseal line when the bone is growing in length. And so there is this proximal epiphyseal line. There's going to be one in the distal epiphysis as well. So bone grows in length at both ends. So you would know then that there are what? Osteoblasts in this area as we're growing. All right, so what is a stronger tissue? Is bone stronger or is cartilage stronger? Bone is a lot stronger, right? Okay, so as somebody is growing up, they have this cartilage disc on either end of the bone, and you told me that cartilage is not as strong as bone, and so this is easily damaged compared to other components of a youngster's bone. It's more sensitive, can be easily damaged by compression, right? That will damage these cells, and if those cells are damaged, what happens to the growth of this bone? It's reduced, maybe it's even stopped, so that bone stops to grow in length. And if the long bones in one side of the body are damaged but not the other, what happens? One side of your body gets to be longer than the other. So I know we all used to get on a swing set and swing as high as we could, right? That was really cool. But what was a really cool thing? As soon as you got really high, you let go of the swing and you start flying through the air. That's wonderful, right? That's wonderful until what? Until you land, right? And you compress all of these bones. That's a really easy way to damage this growth plate in bones. I don't think anybody in here really damaged these growth plates. Everybody looks pretty even from right to left. All right, but that's one way that this epiphyseal plate can be damaged in a young person by compression, for instance. Another way, since this is cartilage, right, it can also be damaged by twisting or torsion. Bone can't because it has all those collagen fibers, but cartilage can. And what is, there's one way that young people can damage these bones by twisting. And that is a lot of young boys like to play baseball, little league baseball, and in particular pitchers. Right? When you throw a baseball, sometimes you throw it straight. Other times you like the baseball to curve around in the air, so it's hard to hit. And in order to get the ball to curve around in the air, you got to put a lot of spin on the ball to do that. Right, so when there's somebody that's in little league and they're trying to throw curveballs and screwballs, things that these balls move around in the air, what do they have to do? They have to put that really rapid twist into the ball, and that twisting can also damage these epiphyseal plates. So young boys in little league are told never to throw a curveball or screwball, things like that, only what? Mostly straight fastballs, and that protects their arm because what would happen if they were to damage these epiphyseal plates? Right? That would damage that arm, which is what? Their dominant strong arm. That would be terrible if that were to happen. Okay. All right. Two things that I didn't talk about, which are easy to pick up, and that is the growth of bone can happen by two ways. If there is cartilage, we call that endochondrial ossification. So if bone forms from a cartilage model, we call that endochondrial ossification. The other kind, and this is what happens for flat bones of the skull are actually a membrane first, and then that membrane ossifies. That means turns into bone, right? That's called intramembranous ossification. So flat bones of the skull are made from intramembranous ossification. Long bones in our body are made from endochondrial ossification. Two little bit different kinds of processes. There's only one really strange bone that kind of looks like a long bone. That's your clavicle. And that's the only long bone that is made from intramembranous ossification. That's kind of an interesting exception to that rule that somebody might ask you about sometime. Okay, so the sign-in sheet is going around. And I'll stop lecturing. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. What's happening? Oh, what's happening next time? You got an exam, so what do you got? You got to get an 882E, Scantron, pencil, really super eraser, picture ID. You need that picture ID. Yeah, have a nice week. Oh, that's right. Nice weekend coming up, huh? Nice long weekend.